Hello and welcome again to the Strange Brew podcast. My name's Jason Barnard and that was George Harrison and Fear of Flying, a redone version of an 80s demo of George with backing from Walrus, originally a Charlie Daw song. And I'm playing one of my favourite rarer George songs because I've got the author of George Harrison, the Reluctant Beatle, here today on the podcast, Philip Norman, renowned biographer of Paul and John and much more besides. So let's hear my chat with Philip.
Thanks very much for agreeing to speak with me, Philip. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
I really enjoyed reading George Harrison, The Reluctant Beatle. Your view of George seemed to have grown over the years. Is that something that only deepened with the research that you undertook for this book?
No. I really had to write the biographies of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, really find out about George. The Lennon and McCartney songwriting partnership really pushed him into the shadows. For a long, long time, he stuck with it. He didn't have another person like John and Paul each had each other. He didn't have, you know, a collaborator. So he was on his own, really. And he also, George Martin, their producer, wonderful man though George Martin was fascinated by John and Paul's development and rather sort of overlooked. He said to me once, I was rather beastly to George. So I had to do all those all research into the other two, really, to find out about George. And I'm not unqualified in my admiration for George. He was just such a mixture, such a self-contradictory character. He could be absolutely, truly noble in the concert for Bangladesh, which is really the first big pop rock stars charity concert. And yet at the same time, he broke the first law of being a Beatle, which was you don't screw another Beatle's wife, which he did with Ringo's first wife, Maureen. He would rail against the material world, as he put it. And yet he wrote the first pop song complaining about income tax. His wife, first wife, Patty Boyd, said that he was very, very sweet and lovely until he learned to meditate. Most people improve when they learn to meditate, but George seemed to get much more sort of tetchy and paranoid because he wanted so much to be a mystical being and didn't think he was, mystical enough. So he's a massive contradiction.
I know that you had contact with the Beatles in the early 60s when you were a junior reporter and you had, was it 6 weeks at Apple in 1969?
That's right. It was a long time, yes. In fact, I'd never written about the Beatles. I'd written about them once before when I was a junior reporter in Newcastle on Tyne on their very last tour of Britain. Yes, I was allowed to sort of hang around the Apple House in Savile Row. I was then on the Sunday Times magazine. That happened to be just when Alan Klein was coming in and the Beatles are really breaking up over Alan Klein, Paul on one side, John, George and Ringo on the other. That was an amazing bit of access that I didn't realise at the time how amazing it was. But it was really more the sort of research for the other biographies that taught me about George.
And that's recounted in your excellent memories of your time in We Danced on Our Desks, which captures those early-ish journalistic years.
Yes, that was a dream job on the Sunday Times magazine because in those days, the magazine was just awash with money, basically. They're not today, of course, and none of those colour magazines is today.
Yeah.
But the Sunday Times magazine was, it really had all the new consumer society, the sudden sort of realisation that life wasn't the austere 1950s anymore. And all the sort of ads that represented swinging Britain tended to be in the Sunday Times magazine, like After Eight Mints and White Horse Whiskey and Cosset White Carpets, all those things. And it was independent of the newspaper. It was like on its independent little nation state. And Godfrey Smith, jovial editor, who basically let you do what you wanted. And there was all the money in the world to finance it.
Different times, the 1960s, seems that things were truly swinging.
Oh, well, and also the sort of the willingness to let very, very young people let them take risks, and do what they wanted. In lots of other fields as well, like photography and the cinema and the theatre. The magazine had this consciousness of the aesthetic of the time. So the illustrations, the photography, photographers, people like Don McCullin and David Bailey, and the graphics were Alan Aldridge and David Levine, people like that. So it looked amazing. And it just had power without responsibility, in an old phrase.
And going back to George, one of the more interesting dynamics is that despite him being arguably from the most humble background of any of the Beatles, it was still a very caring and loving, stable background.
That's right. He was the only one, really, who didn't have some sort of trauma in his background. His family were not at all wealthy. His father was a Liverpool Corporation bus driver, and his mother had to have part-time jobs as well. But they were, firstly, wonderful parents. George had older siblings. He had two brothers and a sister, and they were all very nice to George, and he really was rather spoiled and cosseted as he grew up. Strangely enough, because then he turned into the most sort of touchy and paranoid of the four Beatles.
And it was skiffle and rock and roll that, as many of his peers, ignited his love for music.
That's right. Although the others, you see, most people making that transition from this hybrid folk music that was briefly a big craze in the late 50s, that started young lads in Britain having groups, very, very basic, simple groups doing folk music or jazz-derived sort of stuff, gospel. And mostly they just strum guitars, but George taught himself to play the licks, the riffs, you know, the solos. So as a very 14-year-old, he was far better guitarist than lots of other much older lads, including John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Well, the rock and roll. Well, maybe right, maybe wrong. Know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Yeah, the rock and line, the money to the road. The rock and line, the road to ride. The rock and line, the money to roll. And if you want, ride it, gotta ride it like you find it. Get your ticket to the station. The rock and line. ABCWXYZ. Cats in a cover, and he don't see me. I am a rock and roll man, the man in the road. The rock and roll man is the road to ride. Yeah, the rock and roll man, the man in the road. And if you want, ride it, gotta ride it like you find it. Get your ticket at the station. I'm a rock and roll man.
The age dynamic, George being younger than Paul and John, seemed to have a sort of lasting effect. Is that something you recognise?
Absolutely, yes. John was 2 years older than George. And so George's ridiculously childlike, really, by then an art student. And he called George for a long time that bloody kid who's always hanging around. Well, of course, the bloody kid became quite useful. But George always still felt that John was rather patronising towards him until the time of the Sgt. Pepper album. And then John was the first time John ever actually praised something that George did on that album.
In the book, you recount that really interesting period where the Beatles were popular in the UK, but George had a sister in America and he went over there and then played with a local group, didn't he?
That's right. He'd been to America before that famous, you know, expedition in February 1964, soon the 60th anniversary of that. His sister, his older sister, had married a mining engineer and sort of travelled the world, been to South America as well, and lived in Illinois by that time. So George went over there, yes, just thought he would sort of go there and look up some of his musical heroes, and did end up playing with a local band. And it was rather a nice change because the local band didn't discriminate against him for being young.
He gave one of the band members notes of songs that he was writing or something, and that was sadly lost in a fire.
That's right, yes, yes. And in fact, the bass player had a name weirdly like McCartney as well. And yes, George shoved these notes when he went back to England, and the Beatles then really were just about to get going, handed over all these sort of notes for songs and everything, which unfortunately the bloke who received them had a fire at his house and they were all burnt.
One of the themes is that the arc of George's songwriting, you start with Don't Bother Me, which is a pleasant enough song, but doesn't really compare to John and Paul. And then over the 60s, his songwriting grows.
Does really rather slowly. And he's only really allowed one of his own songs on a Beatle album for a long time. Eventually, the Revolver album has three, which is amazing. But kind of no one's nurturing him. He's doing this really on his own. He doesn't find a mentor. George Martin isn't really a mentor to George like he is to John and Paul. And in fact, he submits so many songs far more than ever get onto Beatles albums. So when he does his first solo album, which is All Things Must Pass, a triple album, he's got all these songs that he can put onto this triple album, which a lot of them are rejects from the Beatles sessions.
How was success for him? The impact of Beatlemania, the screaming fans, it seems out of any of them, he didn't necessarily take to it well.
No, he didn't. I mean, he was always a very private. And this public stage that he was on, the most pitilessly, you know, public stage, and particularly in America, he hated the screaming, which, of course, drowned out his painstakingly crafted guitar solos. There was no security, really, in those days. That wore off very quickly. And the lack of privacy and the constant scrutiny of the press in particular got very, very tiresome to him.
And in live shows, he was relegated to, it was just a rollover Beethoven around 1964, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And of course, what one forgets is all those solos that absolutely so much helped to define the Beatles' music all the way through were from George.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, singing, he didn't, you know, his confidence was made him put on a very low level for a long, long time. And Don't Bother Me is kind of George. It's a bit bad-tempered. People are saying, why don't you write some songs like John and Paul? He eventually does that. But he does make big strides, but no one is really mentoring him to do that.
Since she's been gone, I want no one to talk to me. It's not the same, but I'm to blame. It's plain to see. So go away, leave me alone, don't bother me. I can't believe that she would leave me on my own. It's just not right when every night I'm all alone. I've got no time for you right now. Till she's here, please don't come near, just stay away. I'll let you know when she's come home. Until that day, don't come around, leave me alone, don't bother me. No time for you right now, don't bother me. I know I'll never be the same if I don't get her back again. Because I know she'll always be the only girl for me. But till she's
to be a large element of George in that Beatles sound, and it's even replicated in some of the productions that he did in the 70s, whether it's Splinter or Badfinger. They were more Beatles sound than some of the other Beatles were doing in the 70s.
Well, he was the most sort of multifaceted Beatle of them all. John was more than just a songwriter and a performer. You know, he was an artist and later on a peace activist. But George had all kinds of other strings to his bow. He was a really good producer. He actually produced film music, you know, which McCartney never quite did. He did just once, I think. And then he was in the film business. He got into movies. He was a partner in handmade films in the 1980s. Was part of the big revival in British cinema. He had lots and lots of, you know, he had more sides to him than the others.
His marriage to Patti and the dynamic with Eric Clapton and Maureen, and it's a real web.
It really is. It's the weirdest love triangle, yes, because Eric Clapton is George's best friend, although being George's best friend is quite nerve-wracking. You have to be very careful. Clapton does. Clapton then is infatuated with Patty, the then Patty Boyd, who was George's first wife. For a long time, he doesn't even dare admit it. Eventually, he does. George is a serial womanizer. There again, somebody so mystical and so spiritual, on the other hand, is such a womanizer. And he treats Patty so badly in the end that she leaves him for Eric Clapton. But the result of that is that Eric Clapton and George Harrison become even closer friends. And because they're, both, six-string guitar gods. And Patty feels kind of marginalized by that. It's a terrible tale of male supremacy and chauvinism.
And then in the Beatles, the Indian influence, whether it's the sitar or even the mystical element with the Maharishi, for a year or two, that was a critical element of the Beatles.
It was. I mean, they did everything together. They had a thing which psychologists call the group minds. When one grows a moustache, all the other ones grew moustaches. But George found something, not only that he personally, there was a lack in his life that he sort of compensated for by turning to Indian culture and classical music, that sort of thing. That became an influence on the Beatles music. But it stayed with George. The others, it was sort of blew over, just like the craze for the latest moustache or shirt. George stuck with it, of course, and was part of his consciousness for the rest of his sadly too short life.
As we were discussing earlier, by 1968, 69, whether it's Something or Here Comes the Sun, the material, it's not second division Beatles anymore, it's the top. And even when you look at online streaming now, it's his material that are the most listened to.
The most streamed, yes, they are. Mind you, he did write a few dud ones as well, you know. And I don't think Paul and John ever wrote a dud one. In the end, George Martin became interested in him enough to say that, you know, this one or that one isn't good enough and you should try again. But that was what a sort of a mentor would have done all along.
In that period as well, his relationship with Bob Dylan, it was quite interesting because it feels that they had a bit more of a healthy relationship, something a more like peers.
Well, yes, outside of the Beatles, where George felt marginalised, he didn't get the same treatment. And that included from Bob Dylan or from the band, who were originally Bob Dylan's band. And they made much more of him than his own bandmates in the Beatles did. And he would stay with Bob Dylan, or he would stay with the band. And it was really, you know, a great relief to him. He was given recognition.
And as you were saying earlier, in terms of All Things Must Pass, where do you see that in the pantheon of the post-Beatles albums? For me, it's up there and a real flowering of that songwriting talent.
It is, but that's really made up very much of rejects from the Beatles section. And he said, you know, we're leaving the Beatles was like recovering from a 6-year dose of constipation. And so it must have felt. That album outsold either John or Paul's first solo album by many, many times.
Sunrise doesn't last all morning, and a cloudburst doesn't last all day. Seems my love is up and has left you with no warning. But it's not always gonna be this way. All things must pass. All things must pass away. And a sunset doesn't last all evening, and a mind can blow those clouds away. And after all this, my love is up and must be leaving. But it's not always gonna be this way. All things must pass. All things must pass away. All things must pass. All things must pass away.
And how did things progress in the 70s? Because you've got the 1974 tour, which wasn't well received. It feels like he kind of almost toured at the wrong time. Then he played a few Beatles songs, but he was changing lyrics. While My Guitar Gently Weeps was While My Guitar Tries to Smile.
Yes, all of the Beatles were left with this sort of almost post-traumatic stress, as if they'd been in a terrible war, because life as a Beatle could often be so pressurized and so dreadful. And they all kind of tried to ignore, obliterate their past in the first years after the breakup. And George, you have to admit that being around two songwriters like John and Paul, you know, did help him, of course. And on Here Comes the Sun, for instance, which was, you know, hugely, perennially successful, George John, he sounds a lot like John on that. So, and in fact, there was a sort of dropping off of quality into the mid-70s. And that tour, it was the final papers were about to be signed at last of the Beatles' breakup as well. He insisted on equal billing with his great guitar guru, Ravi Shankar, and didn't want to play Beatles material on that American tour. And of course, people wanted him to, and promoter Bill Graham wanted him to. So he sort of rather sulkily, you know, changed what everybody knew by heart.
smile. Every mistake we must surely be learning. Still my guitar is trying to smile.
The new aspects that you shine a light on is the financial element of handmade films and how George seems to be conned out of a lot of money. And I'm not sure that much has come out of that before.
No, there hasn't. And again, this is another contradiction. George is terribly keen on money, but he cannot stand any sort of business meetings. And in the end, when they finally get rid of Alan Klein, who has been this dreadful sort of crook who's been controlling the Beatles from just before the breakup and for a long time afterwards, and George decides to have, instead of a manager, a financial advisor, and he picks someone even more crooked than Alan Klein, who's called Dennis O'Brien, an American lawyer, in partnership in the handmade film company, which does very well in the 80s, particularly. All the money to finance these films comes from bank loans, and they're supposed to have signed these two, George and Dennis O'Brien, supposed to have signed the guarantees together, but actually Dennis O'Brien has not signed the guarantees, so only George is responsible for the debt. And he finds himself in the end, you know, liable for loan repayments of something like £38 million, which fortunately the Beatles anthology, that big series of albums and videos, comes along and helps him out. But it's a horrible discovery, you know. It's another moment when you think, instead of people thinking, gosh, I'd love to be a Beatle, you think, I'm so glad I'm not a Beatle.
But at the same time, there's an element of stability, whether it's the time spent gardening with his gardener in Friar Park or the role of Olivia.
Well, yes, he had this huge Gothic folly of a mansion, Friar Park, has enormous gardens. It's rather like a Victorian theme park. It has replicas of the Blue Grotto and the Matterhorn, the mountain, the Matterhorn. George absolutely adores gardening, and that is a relief from the strain, really, of being who he is. And he thinks in the end he'd rather be remembered as a gardener than as a musician.
But the role of Jeff Lynne, whether it's Cloud Nine and the success there and topping the charts, as well as the Travelling Wilburys, that was a real sort of commercial renaissance in the late 80s and early 90s.
That's true. He forms a sort of a super group, really, with Bob Dylan and Jeff Lynne, formerly the Electric Light Orchestra, and Roy Orbison and Tom Petty. That is completely unlike the Beatles. They're a true brotherhood, and that's very good to George after what he went through, the politics of being in the Beatles. And also, they do very, very well. It's a kind of gentle, skiffly sort of music where, you know, there's lots of alien new musical forms around. A lot of people from George's generation love this sort of skiffle for the 80s, it was called. And so that kind of reignites his willingness to play live in a band, which he thought he never would again.
They're waltzing round the room tonight in someone else's clothes. You're always coming out of things smelling like a rose. Hang your head and your heart is filled with so much misery. But you'd be happy as you could be if you belonged to me. Will you say, let's go to the rodeo and see some cowboy fall? Sometimes it seems to me you have no sympathy at all. And your head and your heart is filled with so much misery. But you'd be happy as you could be if you belonged to me. And it ain't easy to get to you. There must be some kind of a way. If only to connect with you for one moment of each day. You say that you're all washed up, got nothing else to give. Seems like we never figured out how long you got to live. But you could feel like a baby again, sitting on your daddy's knee. And you'd be happy as you could be if you belonged to me.
Post-Amphology, and as we move into the late 90s, his health, whether it's cancer, being attacked, things seem to go downhill.
Well, the last chapters, unfortunately, are, you know, unremittingly grim and tragic. Yes, because he's been, even at his most mystical, he's a chain smoker of cigarettes. He starts way back at school and never really gives it up. For a short time, he tries to. And he's diagnosed with cancer. He thinks it's in remission. And then he's attacked at Friar Park by a demented fan. It's almost like a repeat of John Lennon's death. Someone who is so obsessed with the Beatles, he wants to harm a former Beatle. He's stabbed 40 times by this bloke, very near the heart. He never is quite the same after that. But then the cancer returns, and in a much more serious form. And he can't stay the house and in his garden because he knows the press will be outside waiting for him to die. He becomes like a nomad, really, and searching for a cure that isn't there. So the last chapters are really, you know, heartbreaking.
After his death, the album Brainwashed was released, which is a fine album and maybe a second to All Things Must Pass. And his legacy and life, the idea of him being sort of second division Beatle, it's not fair anymore.
No. At his best, he is equal to Lennon and to McCartney. But it never seemed to make him very happy. And perhaps it didn't make either John or Paul that happy, possibly in the end, because what went with it was such a lot of pressure. And what the Beatles went through because of Beatlemania and afterwards is quite horrible to sort of to review now. But yes, that album really made in the shadow of death, with his son Danny helping him. A sort of gallows humour hung over the whole thing. And Ringo Starr, who was always an ally of George's, even through the Beatle Wars, because George did help Ringo a lot when Ringo wrote the occasional song. And even at George's seduction of Ringo's first wife, Ringo got over that. And Ringo said that when he went to see George, he was desperately ill, by that time living in Switzerland. And Ringo had to leave. Ringo then had to go on to America, where his daughter had just been diagnosed with a brain tumour. And George said, "Shall I come with you?" Ringo said, "That was George at his most fantastic."
You've been writing books related to the Beatles for over 40 years now. Do you think that this will be the last one connected to the group?
I really hope so. I've written on other people, Jimi Hendrix, the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, Buddy Holly. They're all part of one story, really, which is this amazing sort of flowering of British popular music in the 1960s and how it originated and how it, for a while, really did dominate popular culture. But they are very, very hard work to write, to make a proper biography out of pop music, which is full of dross. You have to find a new way of saying the record went to number 3 in the Billboard Hot 100. You have to say that. How do you say it in an interesting way? It's a constant headache.
Philip, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I've really enjoyed reading George Harrison, The Reluctant Beatle, and I really enjoyed reading your memoir as well, We Danced on Our Desks, which I thought was an outstanding piece of writing. So thanks again.
Thank you very much. Thank you. My pleasure. Bye.
You can take a heart.
Thank you for listening to the Strange Brew podcast. If you do like the show, please consider a small donation to help keep the show archive online. It's 10 years since I started the podcast, and hosting fees are increasing over time. All your support keeps the show running and helps me get amazing guests. To support me, just go to thestrangebrew.co.uk, where you'll see a donate button on the homepage. Thank you very much. Plus, any reviews on your podcast services help to spread the word too. Thank you.